John Batchel with David Petrucia. Roosevelt sweeps nation, and we go to the nominees for the Republican Party in 1936 to face the president running for re-election. President weighed down by all these opponents, and we need a Republican opponent because that will be the major party. And the first Republican opponent in the president's mind is, I want to run against Hoover. Does the Republican Party want to run Hoover, David?
Well, you might not want to relitigate 1929 and 1932 again. So while there's a little bit of nostalgia for him, and he gives a whiz-bang talk at the Republican National Convention, no, the answer is absolutely not. We don't want to go there again.
And Hoover reluctantly backs away. I say reluctantly because he's making better speeches now. You note that he's not stuck the way he was in 28, very, very hard, very difficult, and what you say, slow-paced presentation. He's making much furrier remarks. But we need to go to the other choice, at least early in the year. William Borah, known as the Lion of Idaho, another character that you can't make up, David. So much of this strikes me all these decades later as characters out of a novel, not out of history. What do we need to know about Borah? And did Roosevelt want to run against Borah?
Borah was a old line progressive, but the very definition of a maverick. He rarely supported a Republican candidate for president. And often when he didn't, he just sit it out in terms of peak. He was also, aside from being the Lion of Idaho, he was the Stallion of Boise and got around, shall we say. And one of his conquests was Theodore Roosevelt's daughter, Alice Roosevelt Longworth. Notice the Longworth there, where not only was she was married to the speaker of the future speaker of the House of Representatives, Nick Longworth. So he was an interesting guy and a great orator and a progressive and an isolationist. And he meets a lot with Franklin Roosevelt early in this campaign season. And the old guard Republicans in Northeast are wondering if this guy is really just a shill for Franklin Roosevelt. He's going to run, not get the nomination, and then spend the rest of the campaign lambasting the Republicans.
Right. It's a good suspicion. Frank Knox, Colonel Frank Knox, a rough rider from the Teddy Roosevelt rough riding in Cuba. But these many years later, he's a very prominent newspaper man and Republican. He also is a man who's been created by Hearst, but is now independent of Hearst, and spends a lot of time on horseback, as far as I can see, campaigning. What does Knox represent to the Republican Party?
Boy, that's a good question, because he had been more progressive, and then he gets very, very agitated about Franklin Roosevelt as the campaign goes on and makes wilder and wilder charges. So he's, again, one of these political amateurs. He'd never run for office before, and he's not quite ready for prime time. It's interesting that Franklin Roosevelt during the war is going to reach out and make him Secretary of the Navy, as he makes Mr. Stimson Secretary of War, a couple of old Republicans.
Frank Knox will spend a lot of time traveling to the Pacific to meeting with Chester Nimitz. We're talking about moments in time here that they flash before you. Frank Knox is a very brave man. However, the Republicans also have Arthur Hendrick Vandenberg, a newspaper man from Michigan, who has a great quote: if we make the old deal, the issue will lose. However, he is also known as someone who can strut sitting down. What does he represent for the party? This is a possible nominee.
Basically mainstream Republicanism. You know, he's not too conservative. He's not too liberal. He's more conservative than probably the country and the party wants this year. He also has this great idea, or pushes an old idea into fruition early on in the New Deal, which Franklin Roosevelt is going to claim credit for, which is to insure bank deposits, the FDIC. And once this goes into effect, then the banking system is stabilized. Money pours back into the banks. They start investing money in the businesses, industry, and the economy really picks up. So he has, even though he may be not the most pleasant or humble guy in the world, he does have some accomplishments in the political system, but he's pretty much dark horse territory outside of Michigan.
And finally, we turn. There are other names mentioned in the early polling, the governor of Illinois, former governor of Illinois, Frank Loudon, and but we're going to concentrate now on the complete surprise. His name is Alf Landon. He is now, at this point, when they're entertaining him, the governor of Kansas. But other than that, David, I can't find any reason for the Republicans to go to him other than the fact that he was none of the above. And they didn't much know him. He was a millionaire, and he was not secretive so much as unremarkable, is my reading of him. How did you read him?
He's the least interesting character in the book. I mean, you see how many interesting characters we have. He was known as, well, when you have so few Republican office holders left after the big blowouts of 1932 and 34, you have a limited talent pool. He's known as the Kansas Coolidge, a nickname he hates because he is not a Coolidge Republican. He's not a conservative. He's a progressive Republican, but he has balanced the budget. He has cut government spending in Kansas. And Hearst takes a look at him. He's urged to look at him by another publisher named Paul Block. And they go out, they visit with him. And even though there are a lot of policy differences between Hearst and Landon, he just falls in love with him. And he orders people like Damon Runyon to write newspaper pieces on what a great guy Landon is. And when you have hundreds of thousands of column inches in the Hearst papers devoted to Landon and not too much to choose from, by the time the convention rolls around, it's pretty much Landon's to lose, and he's not going to lose it.
Yes, the puzzle here is that Landon's governor by accident is the way I read your reporting, David.
It's a fluky election in 1932. There's a Democrat incumbent in Kansas, and he's not too bad. But there is a goat gland doctor, I think named Brinkley,
yes,
who is selling these things to get the juices flowing, so to speak. And often these things end up killing his patients. But he has a 50,000 or 500,000, this huge radio station out there blanketing the midsection of the country with his wares and his ideas. And it's one of those really rare three-way races. I mean, you always get third parties and maybe they get 12% or 2%, but it's like 34, 32, 31% in the finals. So it's a complete fluke that Landon is elected. The trick is to get reelected in 34. And he does that and reasonably easily, not a huge landslide, but by Republican standards in 34, he's a rock star.
Do they listen to him on the radio? Do they hear his voice? Is that part of their notes about him?
No, he's pretty awful. In an era of radio stars like Coughlin and Roosevelt and Huey Long, he just emphasizes everything and is just, you'd be better off with dead air.
Yes, you notice how the technology is a subplot in the campaign of 36. When we come back, the facts of the matter. David, Patricia, the book is Roosevelt Sweeps Nation. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.